From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Carl Wojdeck is a retired senior instructor at the University of Oregon School of Music and Dance, a saxophonist, a radio host, and longtime friend. Hi,
yes.
Carl. Thanks for being on the Oregon Grapevine.
It's great to be here.
Let's start with perhaps an obvious question, but why jazz? Why is that your genre?
That's a very good question. I would say that even when I was a kid listening to rock and roll, I was drawn to instrumental rock and roll. For some reason, I really like instrumental music. It's the same thing with classical music. I like a lot of instrumental classical music. So I think I've been drawn to classical music even before I knew that was a genre. But I would say that when I was early in high school, I discovered jazz. And it really piqued my curiosity. And I was very, very lucky to hear some seminal jazz musicians very, very early on in person. For example, when I was about 15 and a quarter or something like that, I went to a club and heard John Coltrane live. And it changed my life. I mean, it really did. This was a club in Cleveland where I grew up that had no liquor license. So a toddler could walk in and, you know, could check out John Coltrane. So I had some early influences that really influenced me. And I thought, well, I'd like to try to do that.
And this was before you yourself were playing music? Or were you also...
I had not gotten my first saxophone by that time. I had taken piano lessons, which didn't really stick. I'd have to say my teacher was unimaginative. And no, seriously.
I know, I believe you.
My brother was taking piano lessons, and I thought, I'd really like to do that. And then we got this teacher who did not take my curiosity and do anything with it. I remember he sat down at the piano and played a chromatic scale, two octaves. And I said, what is that? Oh, that's a chromatic scale. So let's talk about your lesson. he had my interest, but did nothing with it.
This is bouncing around a little, but with that lesson in mind, you having, I know, taught a lot of people about music and how to play, is that a lesson that you kind of carry with you, that when someone expresses some interest that may be outside what you were thinking, you are easier to go for it?
Well, I do think so. I wasn't conscious or anything like that. But the lessons should really work with the I taught a lot of private saxophone lessons for many years in this town, sometimes like 24 a week or something like that, before I got into the university milieu. So I think if not consciously, certainly instinctively, realized that teaching should be imaginative. It should work with the student's curiosity and have some energy and have some humor and so forth and start where the student is.
At what point did you make the connection or start doing radio and see the connection with jazz and radio, and how did that come about?
Well, that's interesting. Well, in Cleveland, I had a friend who was a DJ at a college radio station. It was called Western Reserve University, eventually Case Western Reserve. And he said, well, you know, I think this is really a lot of fun. And how would you like to have your own radio show? So I thought, well, okay, I'll try that. And so even before I came to KLCC, I did have some experience with public radio.
And you came here and you showed up, or well, the other actual building, but to KLCC's greater entity, or did someone recruit you?
Well, I moved to Eugene in July of 1975, and that was a time when KLCC was running their very first fundraiser, the Book a Watt fundraiser, and I would see a billboard about that. So I decided to check out this radio station, and I walked in, probably late summer in 1975, something like that, and met some wonderful people, such as Michael Canning and many other people, and they were interested. I'm told that Michael Canning, after I walked out the door after our first meeting, he said, "That's the future of KLCC."
Dear Michael, well, he's right. You're here. You are, decades later, right? We both are, but you longer than I. Do you get either on the radio or when you're performing? Do you get stage fright?
In general, no. But if there's a very difficult passage coming up, I sometimes tense up and flub it. Even though at the rehearsal or the sound check, I played through it. So I do have that quirk. But in general, no, it's fun to be on stage with wonderful musicians.
You are retired in terms of your teaching at the University of Oregon. How are you spending your time? Totally retired in your life, or how are you spending your time and playing with that musical piece that I know is still important?
Well, I have to say that over time, an academic piece became very prominent in my life, writing books, for example. And so I still give lectures, I still write articles, I still go to the occasional conference. My most recent, in 1996, I published a particular book, and I most recently updated in 2020. So I'm not doing any kind of long-form thing. But I do have a scholarly aspect which fascinates me. And right now I'm writing two essays for the Oregon Festival of American Music, January 2026 festival, so for the program guide. So I do have that. But I most recently, it's been about 2 months since my last gig, which is at this wonderful, wonderful club that we have in Eugene called the Jazz Station, which is a rarity in the world. It's a nonprofit. There's a board. A few people do get paid to be the continuity and development and so forth, but a lot of people are volunteers there. And jazz musicians really love this club because, first of all, it's a listening room where people come and really know what's going on. And by the way, these may be 18-year-olds. There's a wide variety of audience there, and they seem to know what's going on. So there's that. And also, I would say musicians really relate to the fact that we're treated fairly there. Because every musician or every jazz musician has some horror stories of exploitative club owner or something like that. I could tell stories. But I know exactly what's happening at the Jazz Station in terms of our compensation, and we're treated with a lot of respect. So I really do enjoy performing still.
You mentioned 18-year-olds, and in terms of your observation in the classroom, at the university, playing with musicians, has the demographic changed or the perspective changed of, are people more sophisticated or less sophisticated or more interested in different kinds of pieces of jazz, and how does that work for you? Does it take you by surprise?
Good questions. For many decades, I taught rock history at University of Oregon. And the last time I taught was just into the pandemic, summer of 2020. And I have to say that I have a bit of a jaundiced view of audiences in general. I would say that younger people are more inclined, more disinclined to assertively take charge of their listening spheres. Instead, many, too many in my view, take music as mass media gives to them, and they take it, what would you say, unmediated. They just take whatever is hot, whatever comes to them. And I have to say that I found that true of my students over time. I taught rock history for a long time and jazz history at the University of Oregon School of Music. And my students were, I would say, to some extent, the exception. I had more students who were assertively seeking out music and making choices, but I did see it change over time. I had more students who were passive in terms of the music that were parts of their lives. I would say that actively participating in choosing your music is somewhat of a rarity now among young people. There are the exceptions, and we live for those exceptions.
You've raised my curiosity about why you say that.
Well, from what I saw in my students.
In terms of them not being creative, or in terms of just kind of not wanting to explore beyond the boundaries, or what?
Well, I taught large classes, so it would be about 150 people, and I learned how to put on a show and to keep the attention of the students. And the students who sat in the first 5 or 10 rows were actively curious and asked questions and came to office hours and so forth. However, many of them, I would say, were not very curious. And I do track some social criticism of today's music scene online, like on Substack and so forth. I'm under the impression that a lot of younger audiences are not selective and do not ask very much from the artists.
I'm curious about your point of view that you have noticed that some students are, you use the word not mediating their media choices, that they're just kind of being fed what they do and they aren't. Is that a change, do you think, over time? Do you think as social media has stepped in, as the media has gotten more powerful, it's just easier to be complacent? Or is it just kind of a generational thing? Or what is your observation about that change?
I do think it's easier to be complacent, absolutely.
You have confessed to being an instrumental music fan, and obviously we, those of us who know you and have listened to you, think of you as, you know, it's jazz. I mean, he listens to jazz. So what's your secret vice genre that's out there that you'll actually listen to something else? Is there one that you'll turn on and instead?
Well, no, I don't think I have a secret vice, but I get tremendous satisfaction from listening to classical music. And I love classical music concerts. I love classical music in a recorded fashion, but I love classical music concerts. And I've had a lot of transcendent experiences in the classical music concert hall.
Do you find yourself playing classical music too, sometimes either with friends or for relaxation, in terms of actually playing it on your instrument?
No, I don't really play it very much on my instrument. But for many decades, many, many decades, I taught middle school and high school saxophone students who in some cases had to play classical music. Some of them were involved in competitions. And for various reasons, I had to up my game in terms of my knowledge of classical music and teaching it. And so I had, you know, a student who would go to what they call go to state, in other words, to the state competition, and perhaps even be the winner of a state competition for tenor saxophone or something for a particular year. So I had to learn how to teach that.
You travel a bit and you get around. You've heard a lot of musicians. Are there places or people that you are hoping in your life to still go out and listen to? There's someone out there that you're going, you know, I need to track this person down. I want to see them in live.
Oh, certainly. I would say more, there are people who are younger whose careers I track very carefully. And whenever I'm in New York, for example, I go to see these people. These are younger, for example, the young pianist Miki Yamanaka, who has been living in New York for some decades. I will always go to see her. And also there's a singer who is Armenian-born named Lucy Yagizarian that I will, if I can ever see her, I will. And not so long ago, she was at the Oregon Coast Jazz Festival. And hearing her sing was one of the highlights for me.
You just let slide the fact that you've written a book. Go ahead and talk about that book a little bit. Brag a little bit about your publication.
Oh, well, I've put out three different books. Two are what are considered to be edited volumes. In other words, I wrote part of them. I, as they say now today, curated, or whatever you want to say, edited it. I solicited the essays, and I wrote some of them. But the one that we're talking about is called Charlie Parker, His Music and Life, first published by University of Michigan Press in 1996. And as I mentioned, the revised edition in 2020, that was the centenary of the birth of Charlie Parker. So I wanted to put out a new edition. So these are, especially that book, is for specialists. There's a lot of transcribed music. If you can read music, you'll get a whole lot more. So I would say that those, I wouldn't recommend to anybody to go out and order that book. However, the other two are out of print, unfortunately.
So don't try to order them either.
Well, they float around. You can find them in used form. One is called the Charlie Parker Companion, and one is called the John Coltrane Companion.
What inspires you in your life and to continue doing the work that you're doing, and what keeps you going and vibrant?
Well, I would say life itself is inspiring. To have energy, to have curiosity, to love nature, to love art, to love my wife, to be crazy about our great dog, taking walks, traveling. I love to travel. About a year and a half ago, my wife and I did a nice tour of three different European countries. We go to New York whenever possible. So I would say, you know, life itself, energy, people, art, all those things inspire me.
Do you have contact with former students who come up and interact with you in interesting ways? Some you might recognize, some you might not, but are you in touch with them?
My wife, Marion Smith, jokes with me about this because we can be in British Columbia or California or someplace, and people will say, I took your Miles Davis course. I took your rock history course. I took your blues history course. I did this and that. Oh, so yes. And then also, I'm in touch with some of my saxophone students. And also, I'm in touch with quite a few of my graduate teaching fellows, graduate employees, they call it at University of Oregon, who are my assistants when I was teaching those huge classes, because you can't just teach a 150-person class easily. You need help, grading and so forth. So I'm in touch with a wide variety, from saxophone students to school students to the people who work with me, these graduate assistants.
Are you also a composer?
My bachelor's degree is in classical music composition. However, I'm more interested now in just playing saxophone and improvising and arranging and so forth, and a little bit of composition, but mostly I'm interested in leading a band and getting on the stand and improvising on the saxophone.
And do you have a band or a kernel of group of people with whom you play?
Well, in little old Eugene, we have a certain cadre of musicians who I consider to be what they would call the A-list. These are people that I would want. And if I can't get enough of these, I will turn down a job because I want a smooth ride, you know, when I play. I want a smooth ride. And so there are musicians here who are great on their instrument, people who are easy to work with, and who are very creative on the bandstand. I have to say also that these musicians who are on my A-list are in demand. And a lot of times they're busy. I'll text them and say, I have a possible job on October 24th. Can you do it? No. Plus, also, I would say that musicians who come through the jazz studies program at the University of Oregon, who are often the people that I start to employ, they often go to greener pastures. We had a wonderful bassist who came through our program, Garrett Baxter, who is, he grew up in Ashland, but he now lives in Portland and is very much in demand, and it right now is being considered for a job at a very prestigious German big band. And so musicians develop here, either just in Eugene or especially at the School of Music and the Jazz Studies program, and oftentimes they leave, and as well they should.
You were a city boy, you lived in Cleveland, and you came to Eugene, and you weren't one of those people that passed through and kind of kept going. What drew you to Eugene? First, why did you find Eugene, or how, and why are you still here, Carl?
Well, for people like you, Barbara.
Thanks, Carl.
So not only have I lived in Cleveland, but I also, in the late 60s and early 70s, lived in Berkeley, California. And after living in Berkeley for professional reasons and various reasons, I went back to Cleveland. But I knew I wanted to get back to the West Coast, partly for the landscape, the terrain, the people, the quality of life, nature, and so forth. And so I looked at a number of locations, Berkeley, Santa Cruz, Seattle, and so forth, and Eugene seemed to be the place where I could most easily slide in and make my mark. And why have I stayed? Well, actually, I joke with people saying, this is one of my failings in life of not having, of being in one place too long or a long time. Because when you're young, you have wanderlust and so forth, and you go a lot of places. However, my wife and I spent a lot of time in Austin, Texas, which is her home city. So I get to see a lot of the country, and perhaps someday I'll move again.
But for now, we're glad you're here. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a radio show question, which is that you've been doing your show on KLCC for a long time, 50 years. How do you still stay inspired to go in there and go, well, I have to do this show, or I get to do this show, or here's who I'm going to focus on? How do you keep that desire going?
Well, I guess that from the time I started doing radio, I wanted to share my interest and my energy and my fascination with others. And that's what I get to do, not only when I was teaching in person, but also sharing it with people who are out there, either online or listening on a radio. I really enjoy sharing my fascination and my love of music.
Do you ever listen? Do you even have an archives of old ones and listen to past ones and think, oh, maybe I'll change that up a little bit and do it again?
Well, during the pandemic, along with a lot of other people, I created about 50 shows when we weren't coming into the radio station. So I got a good microphone and learned software and so forth. So, I mean, I do have an archive of those, but I wish I had an archive of some of those shows from the 70s and 80s, I'd be very curious to hear some of those.
Those reel-to-reel tapes, I suspect, are gone.
Yes.
At this point in your life and at this point of living in Eugene and doing all the things you've done and being here and sometimes going to Austin and other places, what's kind of next for you in terms of your desire or your bucket list, if you will, of the next kind of thing you and your wife will do?
Well, certainly, let's just say in the next year, I look forward to going back to Europe, especially the Mediterranean, and experiencing that, and also getting to New York as often as possible, which is, to me, growing up, it was a beacon of culture for me. And so I would say that travel. A friend of mine says that there's three stages of retirement. Go-go, slow-go, and no-go. And so, as long as I've got the go-go, I intend to travel, and my wife Marion and I intend to travel.
Good. You're on go-go, then slow-go, and maybe eventually no-go. But what? Hopefully not soon.
I thought it wouldn't happen to me. You're telling me this? Barbara, I've got a go-go right now in that case. I didn't realize that no-go was part of my... No, but seriously, I'm basically, as long as I have the go-go energy, I'd like to experience life and people and art. Inhaling art is very important to me, but especially travel. And I'd like to get back to Europe, see some of my European friends. Getting to New York would be wonderful as often as possible. And also just being in warm... Someone said that they didn't realize that winter was optional. So here we are in Eugene in the Northwest. You know, well, I'd like to spend more time in warmer climes. So I would say as long as I'm go-go, I want to go-go.
Thank you, Carl Woideck, for being on the Oregon Grapevine. And you go-go and stay in touch and keep us happy on the radio.
Thank you, Barbara.
You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh, pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.